guest on this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, Marcus Samuelson, and his new best-selling memoir, Yes, Chef.
After we were done with cooking the dinner, and we were just tired, they told us, hey, the president's going to come and say good night and thank you for the dinner. So my team goes into the special room, and the first lady and the president comes, shakes everybody's hand, and we just thank you for giving us the opportunity. And then one of my chefs, Michael, he gets so nervous when he's going to meet the president. So he just screams out in the middle of the room, "Yes, chef!"
Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Coming up next. But first, the news.
Hi, this is Cheryl Castillo. Join me each week on The Exchange for conversations with musicians, artists, dancers and writers, poets and actors, and everything else in between. Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 3 a.m., here on listener-supported public radio for Acadiana, KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Rossini might well have become famous for his William Tell overture alone, but there's more to the score than its iconic curtain raiser, as you'll hear in a complete production of the opera from the Royal Theater in Turin. I'm Lisa Simeone. Join me for Rossini's William Tell, next time on World of Opera.
Monday night at 7 on KRVS.
Finest in classic ska, rock steady, rockers, DJ, dance hall, and dub. It's Jamon. Cecil here, bringing you Southwest Louisiana's longest running reggae tradition, Jamon. Jamon Sunday nights from 9 to 11 p.m. or Saturday mornings from 1 to 3 a.m. and streaming live anytime at krvs.org.
Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. This week, we're going in search of the taste of home. Since our country's founding, newcomers have brought their unique flavors of home with them. After all, food is one of the most accessible ways to learn about other cultures, and the place we can all come together is at the table. In researching her book, New Orleans' Best Ethnic Restaurants, Anne Benoit learned firsthand what it takes for immigrants to achieve the American dream. She'll tell us all about it. Then, we'll visit Fatma and Suleyman Aydin at their Turkish restaurant, Fetouche, to hear the story of their assimilation. And author Kim Suni explains how her life as an adopted Korean orphan inspired her to wander the world searching for her own personal taste of home, a story she chronicles in her new book, A Mouthful of Stars. Bring along your fork for a taste of the world on this week's Louisiana Eats. Author Kim Suni has insatiable appetites for travel, for knowledge, and especially for food. She's the author of the best-selling memoir, Trail of Crumbs, Hunger, Love, and the Search for Home. In her new book, A Mouthful of Stars, Kim continues her search for the flavors of home, and this time shares many favorite recipes discovered along the way.
You know, I think food chose me in a way, rather than me choosing food. But I think as a career or more professionally, it didn't come until much later. For me, it was really poetry and language that I loved the most. And I wanted to be a poet. And of course, my family thought that was the most non-lucrative thing one could ever do. I was actually a writing student at NOCA. That was a difficult program back then. It was way up on Perrier when we had no air conditioning, first of all. And I actually, for some reason, thought I wanted to be a journalist, which had nothing to do really with the type of writing that I love to do. Writing is difficult, but I think I did it because it was a way to make sense of the world, or my world in particular. And I think because I was adopted and I don't really have any true records of who I am, that to actually put something in black and white in print, it gives me my own history, and it gives me a definition, not the defining thing about myself. But writing in general is a way to sort of distill moments, good and bad, or happy and joyful. And so that's why I started writing. And then cooking came along with that, because maybe cooking is the joyful side of sometimes writing can be a little bit more melancholy.
So somehow you found your poetry in food?
I think so. And recipes are like poems to me. And I think that's why in this new book, A Mouthful of Stars, I wanted to include poetry.
Well, your new book begins with the story of your exploration of your biological heritage in Korea.
Yes.
How did that journey of discovery begin?
There was a Korean edition of my book, Trail of Crumbs, and the publisher invited me and I went back to Seoul, and I thought I was going there just to be an author and sign books and so forth. And once I got to Korea, there was this, just the media and publicity, and everyone all of a sudden decided they wanted to help me find my birth family. But I also met some other adoptees who were there, and so the journey turned very differently and unexpectedly, and it was pretty emotional.
There's a beautiful story about someone who thought maybe he was your brother.
Yes. I would get emails every once in a while from Koreans and saying, oh, I think you might be my daughter, or I think you might be my sister. And I don't know why, but I always ignored those. Not ignored them, but I didn't want to imagine that maybe, it was real. And then this one particular man really pursued it, and then I didn't hear from him for a while. But when I was there, he found out I was there, and he contacted the producer who was doing a documentary at the time about my journey. And their story made me understand that, I wasn't alone in this. They had lost their daughter and their sister when she was about 3 years old, about my age, in the same 1970s or so. And, we did the whole DNA test. That story's in the book. But I will remember that he came to the hotel the first time and brought a gift. And it was a beautiful Mont Blanc writing pen, because I am a writer. But he had the words "missing you" engraved on the pen. And then he said, I know that all these years someone has been missing you. And so we ended up having this wonderful friendship, and the DNA tests came back, and it was, they were inconclusive. And so I will have to go back. But he said, no matter what, we can choose family and we can choose home.
And sometimes, those are the best family members, the ones you choose.
The ones we choose, exactly.
So you've been to Korea now multiple times. When you begin to eat Korean food for the first time, are there flavors that somehow trigger forgotten memories in your heart?
As a young child, after being adopted, I didn't want cookies or brownies and chocolate and milk and so forth after school. I wanted a bowl of steamed rice with a little pat of butter for several years. And then as I grew older and saw the other kids eating, American snacks, that's what I wanted. But so I think there's something about that came with me and that's inside of me. And then going back to Korea, no matter how difficult it was to feel Korean again or to feel accepted back into the country, I immediately would taste something. And I didn't have all these memories rushing back, but I really felt comfortable eating this food. And it made me feel welcome and grounded.
Does this begin to inform your personal cooking?
A little bit. When I was in Korea, actually, I bought Korean English cookbooks, grandmother cookbooks, just to kind of see. And I actually took some classes while I was there. But it's not something that I can go to easily and make quickly. Like I can throw together a pasta or jambalaya, something like that.
It's a lot more complicated.
It's complicated and it's more thoughtful. You have to really want to do it and think about it. More deliberate.
You mentioned earlier about your love for poetry, and I have, followed your prose as you have written for periodicals, your work with Cottage Living, and you're renowned, award-winning for your prose. But I really didn't know about the poet in you. So in Mouth of Stars, there's a poem that really touched my heart. And I was wondering if I could get you to read whatever feels the best to you. And tell us a little bit about it.
So this poem, you'll find the poem at the end of the Korea section. And I was with a poet, Lee Herrick, who's a poet from California. He was also adopted from Korea.
And he took that trip with you.
He took that trip with me. We met there, actually. And so we went through this whole search for birth families and so forth. And I was thinking about, you know, you're always so conscious of what you're eating and what you're giving to someone else. And then I thought about what our birth mothers might have eaten and so forth, and how that might have affected us. So I think that's what the poem is about. So it's in four sections. And the first one is called, If I Am What I Eat, Then I Am the Raw Jellied Crab Oozing on the Tongue As We Sit in a Small Hot Room in Insadong, Where You, a Man I Have Known My Whole Life, Have Come to Take Pause in the Search of a Birth Mother. This is all we have, this crab, only this time of year, in this part of the world. Years ago, they warned eating it this way could cause temporary memory loss. But that smile on your face as you slurp the sea from one of the legs, and the heat of you, broad golden moon, eyes dark like hot stones. No one will ever know if those are tears or small birds in flight. Like the moments of our childhood, no one recorded, as if remembering would be too much. This temporary moment of forgetting is all we have, and somehow worth it all. 2. If you are what you eat, then you are the salted tomatoes and capers from climbing twisted vines in a town dusted with departure, and feverish kisses to the cheek, the neck, the underside of the palm, as a small boat awaits you. Let us share one last bowl of pasta, you suggest, with anchovy, hot pepper, a swipe of thick country bread drenched in bittersweet golden oil. If I am what you eat, I am the motherlode, the 200-year-old Istrian yeast for a biga, so sweet and swollen. A handful of golden raisins, saffron threads from a song I used to know by heart, a song I sing because I am what you are. If you are what I eat, then you will be a hot puffed donut filled with vanilla-flecked cream. I will be the moon rising and dusting the orchards with light and air, water and wind. Because if you are what I eat, then I will no longer eat fear, the way I used to, when I thought danger could slip into a bowl of noodles, like an unseen poison, like the hatred in countries, in the blackened hearts of people who know nothing of themselves. Because you are what I am, then I will be love and the memories of your childhood, and this is worth everything.
Oh, that is so beautiful, and I love the dichotomy between the two sides of that, because one seems to be clearly about your eastern side, and the other addresses the western side of Kim Sunee.
I just realized that when I was reading it.
Well, I am so grateful that you stopped in New Orleans on your book tour.
Yay, I'm so happy to be home.
And that you decided to stop in and share Kim Sunee with my Louisiana Eats listening audience. So thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Poppy.
Kim Sunee, author of A Mouthful of Stars. Food isn't just a symbol of cultural identity. For the nonprofit organization Old Ways, honoring one's cultural food traditions also means eating healthier dishes than those usually found in American food. The mission of Old Ways is to help guide people to good health by having them take a closer look at their culinary heritage. Recently, the program was offered at New Orleans East Village Desjardins Senior Community Apartments. Dozens of residents eagerly attended every week, and after class, everybody sat down together to enjoy a healthy meal. Our sound engineer, Joe Schreiner, sent in this postcard.
So, did anybody complete their homework? Anybody try a new whole grain that they've never tried before? You can just raise your hand.
I am Alicia Butte, and I'm one of the Old Ways instructors here in New Orleans.
And I'm Phyllis Boudreau, and I'm one of the Old Ways presenters also.
Today we are at Village de Jardin here in New Orleans East.
Well, this week we're going to totally switch it up.
Okay.
You're talking about tubers and mashes. Who knows what a tuber is?
Sweet potatoes.
Sweet potatoes. Is that the only kind of tuber?
Old Ways was started in 1990 to kind of combat all the chronic diseases that are on the rise, like diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure. So we are starting this movement of teaching people how to eat plant-based, healthy foods that are based on the African heritage in an effort to kind of inspire this lifestyle change.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Alicia. How are you guys? I'm going to start off with a question. How many of us are kind of hesitant to try something new because we aren't sure how to prepare it? You know, we've seen the taro, we've seen all these different tubers that we may have never had. Well, we're providing you with a chart of some preparation tips.
Okay. We spoke with the manager, and we found out that they would welcome a program like this for the residents. So we started the program actually 5 weeks ago. It's a six-week program. We've had participants who are not just named participants. They actually participate in everything we do here. They appreciate us being here and the fact that they can live healthier. Okay, dishes we're going to have today. Senegalese sweet potato peanut stew. Woo! Come on, y'all know y'all want to spread.
My name is Tony Hatcher. I stay in Building 16. To me, it's like spinach and potatoes. It would look like spinach and squash and stuff like that. That's what it looked like to me. But it's healthy. What it is, it's a light food. It's not like something heavy on your stomach. It's about teaching us how to eat healthy. Everybody's supposed to eat healthy. But like when you get at that certain age level, you got to really take care of yourself because, you know, when you get around into your 50s and 60s, you're dealing with high blood pressure, diabetic, you know, and stuff like that. And then you got to watch how to eat.
What do we think?
The greens and corn is pretty good.
It tastes good, man.
It's kind of spicy.
Spicy.
It's kind
of spicy.
Yeah. I can't eat nothing spicy.
Young lady.
Yeah.
This tastes good.
Good.
You
like
cooked that?
Nope.
Okay.
That was Miss Phyllis that cooked.
Okay. Go up.
I enjoy because it's something dealing with your health. You know, it's and the teachers and the ladies who come here, and I appreciate them to the highest, you know, for their effort. And I thank them so much. Always got to eat healthy, you know. When you eat healthy, you feel healthy. Your mind is strong, you know, and that's what it's all about.
Turkish-born Suleiman and Fatma Aydin are living the American dream. When we come back, they'll tell the story of what it took to achieve that goal. Stay tuned.
What's happening musically in Dakar? Joburg, Kinshasa, Port Spain, Havana, Accra, Dar es Salaam, Cairo, Paris, New York. Well, tune in this week and every week to find out on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
We're live from the Liberty Theater in Eunice, Louisiana, every Saturday night from 6 to 7:30. Hi, this is Barry Unsley inviting you to join us right here on KRVS for the Rendezvous des Cajuns every Saturday night from 6 to 7:30 with great Cajun music, Zydeco, lots of other regional music, stories, commentary, and who knows what else because we are live from the Liberty Theater in Eunice, Louisiana.
6 p.m. Saturdays on KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. This week, we're having an extended conversation with Marcus Samuelson. As we continue with our interview, New Orleans writer Lolas Eli joins us. Lolas first befriended Marcus on a shared journey to Ethiopia. Here's how that came about. In 2000, you pitched a story to Gourmet Magazine about Marcus traveling to Africa for the first time to explore his roots. How did you and Marcus connect in the first place?
Gideon?
No, Bernard Carmouche, who was chef de cuisine at Emeril's.
There you go.
The great Gene Borg always said his favorite restaurant when he's critic of the Times-Picayune was the one where they knew him, where the chef would come out or whatever. So I asked Bernard, I'm going to New York, where should I eat? He said, you should eat my friend Marcus's place. So I went to Aquavit, and I was blown away. And I'm still not entirely sure how much of that was just not knowing Swedish food and how much of that was Marcus doing something incredible with Swedish food.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. But we also had, we closed the restaurant that night.
Yeah.
We left after the busboys and cleanup people, and we started talking about the possibility of going to Ethiopia. I spoke at the Southern Foodways Alliance. Jane Lear, my editor at Gourmet, heard me. I pitched a story about Marcus. They loved it, but they said, can you do a piece about Leah Chase for the February issue? November, I'm writing about Leah Chase. December, I'm on a plane with Marcus.
Marcus, this was your first trip back to Ethiopia.
Yeah, I started to sort of find out and be comfortable more about my Ethiopian self in New York. I started to get understand the rituals, the music, the food, going to weddings, going to be part of funerals, all these other stuff that I couldn't experience really in Sweden. And all of these sort of led up to this trip. But still, when we went, I didn't know a lot. And it was an out-of-body experience because I felt like a tourist. But I didn't look like one. When you're in that situation, you pick up other things, right? When you don't speak the language and don't know what's happening culturally, things that you understand become so important, like soccer balls or like enjoying a beer or understanding the spice blend of Berbere quickly. Things like this that you can hold on to become so important.
Lolas, what do you remember showing Marcus in Ethiopia? What were the real lightning bolt moments that you shared with him there?
It was the market. And I wish I could say that I had shown it to him. But Gideon Kifle, our mutual friend and a photographer, and the first person I really hung out with in Ethiopia, we go to the market, and Gideon understood how to go several times and kind of slowly insinuate yourself in the market. So what's unimaginable in our neat ordered American supermarkets is the way in which these markets are neatly ordered and colorful. Mounds of orange lentils next to mounds of green lentils. And so the market is an attack of sensations, but it's also the nerve center of the community. This is where you meet. This is where you buy food. This is where you learn stuff. And so this is everything that Marcus is about in one place, both the people and the food.
I mean, that market, when you know a market of the city, you know the city in a way, right? It's a beat. It's a pulse. It's actually a reflection of the city. It doesn't matter if you do this in the Japanese fish market in Tokyo or if you go to the market in my town in Gothenburg, because it's quickly understand what is currency in that country. Currency in Ethiopia is Berbere. People know the price of Berbere, just like much we know the price of gas.
Yes.
Teff, the flour that we make in Jara bread, when that goes up, this is horrible. So what is your currency? I come from a fishing village in Sweden. When you knew, everyone knew the price of shrimp, the price of mackerel. Of course you knew that.
And how did your relationship change after you left Ethiopia? And Marcus, how did Ethiopia change you?
Well, I just knew that this is a side of me that I owe it to myself, my family, to find out more. And I also felt like as a chef, it was a calling for me to start learning about African food. So as I was traveling around the world and cooking, I could start explain the food chasm and the challenges that we have. Because going to Africa, it's also very challenging because you see people eating with a spiritual compass, having a better relationship to food than in most places in the West. But then in just time you see famine and stuff like that. But if we one day going to have an equal relationship with Africa, we have to trade, not just aid. We have to tourist. We have to listen to the music. And I knew as with food and me being having a platform, I knew that I can do my part of that. But I couldn't do it if I didn't know enough.
Well, you're in Harlem now. Your new restaurant called Red Rooster is an homage, I suppose, to the original Harlem Red Rooster, which I understand was a speakeasy back in the early 1900s. And it was described as Harlem's answer to the Stork Club, I've heard. And much, much, much has been made about your move to Harlem.
Yeah.
Explain the role that you are looking to play in Harlem.
You know, for me, it was really about after 9/11 and the economic dip, right? I started asking myself questions. If this is what I'm going to do, what meaningful can I do? Well, changing the footprint of dining and bridging the city of New York in terms of food, I always thought that was something that I could actually participate in. So I was like, I can't just open a restaurant in Harlem. I have to move to Harlem. So I moved to Harlem. And for the first 5 years, I just walked around in the neighborhood a lot. Started to understand, what's El Barrio about, the Puerto Rican, Spanish Harlem? But wait a minute, there's a Mexican community there. There's a large center of African-American heritage, but it's also a Caribbean. There's a Jewish. Even further east, you have the old Italian neighborhood. There's new people coming up, new young families. So all is very complex. It's not just one kind. Why should the food amenities, just because you go north of 96th Street, be lowered?
Absolutely.
There were so many questions that I want to ask myself. So I was like, you know what? I can't open a restaurant now in New Harlem. I had to understand it better. So it took me 5 years to sort of feel comfortable enough saying, you know what? I can do it. Then it took me another 2 years to find the place and build it out. And then 2010, on a cold night in December, we opened.
I would be remiss in letting you get out of here without asking you a few words about a little Swedish specialty that we share together, those little crawfish.
Yes.
So tell me about your first crawfish memories, and let's talk about Louisiana crawfish.
Yeah, I mean, crayfish, crawfish, mudwalk, whatever you want to call them. This is something that Sweden and Louisiana share. New Orleans are known for the great parties. The best parties in Sweden happen second week in August in Sweden. That's when our crayfish party starts happening. You actually set it. This is a time when Swedes go crazy. They set up tables outside, aquavits and vodkas, big cheese. People eat with their hand. This is something that happens all over the world, actually. People do all those things. But in Sweden, not so much. But in the last 2 weeks of August, when the crayfish season starts, and this is where you just basically boil the crayfish in a little bit of salt, dill weed, and sugar, and some beer. You bring it to a boil, maybe simmer it for 3-4 minutes, turn off the heat, let them sit. Don't put your finger in there, let them sit overnight, and then you pull them out. And then you just suck the crawfish. There's not a lot of meat on them, right?
Right.
You just suck the head. You're just messy. And
oh, y'all suck the heads
of
too.
Course, of course.
Oh, that's good.
So this is something that we share, and the eating on a piece of paper as well.
When was the first time you went to a Louisiana crawfish boil?
I didn't have that in Louisiana. I actually had it in New York. I was invited in New York to New Orleans style crawfish boil. But there's other things in there. That the music is definitely better here. I think our cheese is better.
Okay.
You know, there's like, you can trade. You can make this. Maybe Lola's and I should do this perfect crawfish boil in Harlem, where we take the best of, you know, you bring the music and the crawfish, I bring the cheese and the vodka or something
like that. Yeah, I think you need to get working on that.
Yeah, and yeah.
Finally, I want to talk to you about a cultural phenomenon that you are at the very heart of, celebrity chefs. So you've been right there on the front row for the rise of the popularity of this whole celebrity chef cult. What's your thoughts about that?
Well, I think two things. You know, if it brings more people to the space and wants to be cooks, great, fantastic. But if you start cooking and think you're going to be on TV 2 years later, I think you're up for a rude awakening, you know? But I'll tell you one thing. I give one cooking class for free in my community in Harlem every month. So about 6 months ago when I gave one in the local YMCA, I was doing this chicken salad with couscous and feta cheese. And this kid came up to me, 13-year-old kid in Harlem, came up to me. Said, "Chef, stop. Is that cottage cheese or feta cheese?" And I was like, "Wait a minute. It's feta. How would you know that?" Food Network.
Oh.
And it just dawned to me that, wow, there's a whole generation coming into food ingredients in a different way. So as long as we bring them into it, but hopefully also we start making better choices in terms of eating. And I think that's the challenge. We watch more sports doesn't mean we can become healthier. So we got to figure out, if you're into food, great, then figure out how to get healthier, how to have farmers market that makes sense in inner cities, affordable and culture relevant. So I think there is an aspect of it that could be good, but it's also an aspect of it that's very confusing. You know, I got into cooking because of a love for my craft. I'm going to be in cooking when it's not, when maybe the celebrity thing's moved on to plumber or something like that. I'm still going to cook.
Oh boy, I can't wait to meet the celebrity plumbers. Really, thank you. It was such an honor and a treat to have you here in the studio with us. Thank you, Marcus.
Thank you.
Marcus Samuelson of Harlem's Red Rooster Restaurant and his new memoir, Yes, Chef. Rouge-based food writer and photographer Frank McMahon savors the cultural connections of Louisiana as he crosses our state with camera, notepad, and appetite. As Louisiana Eats roving reporter, Frank's sharing with us his latest and greatest food finds. Frank, what are you serving us today?
Hey, Poppy. Well, I've been eating all over the place, but particularly down in South Louisiana recently. That's sort of where my travels have taken me of late. And one of the places that I've really been excited by is a place called Chester's Cypress Inn, which is actually in Shriver. It's a relic of a forgotten Louisiana in many ways. There's this spectacular sort of milk green paint on the siding. It's creaking boards as you walk in. The formica countertop is worn bare from people reaching across to grab frosty mugs of beer. It's got just an ambiance that just can't be recreated in a new environment. And to boot, they're also known for their fried chicken and fried frog legs. So, you know, between ambiance and incredibly good fried chicken, really, what more could you ask for? And they've been, you know, in operation for, you know, the better part of 100 years at this point.
Incredible. Now, for our listeners who don't know where Shriver is, that's in the Atchafalaya Basin, right?
It is. It's sort of in that kind of green strip between the channeled Mississippi and the Atchafalaya Basin, kind of catty corner from Baton Rouge, or more directly west from New Orleans towards areas like Houma, essentially. Yeah, it's just a small little town, but there's a lot of good food to be had there along the bayous. The food there is very unpretentious. It's served on paper plates and just comes right out of the kitchen, where you can see the same person who's you know, working the cash register is back in the back and talking to the chefs and making sure that everything stays right. And the chicken, you can get it a couple of different ways. As you can imagine, it's sort of a traditional and a spicy, and then an extra, extra spicy, which they, of course, recommend. And wash it all down with some cold tap beer. So it's one of those sorts of places that as you're driving along those rural southern Louisiana byways, that they just seem to kind of sink further and further down into the swamp as you're progressing ever southward. It's primordial. You know, it's surrounded by these fantastic great oaks, and it's a great drive down there. And it really gives you a sense of the geographical diversity of the state and just how spectacularly untamed and pretty some of the areas that really aren't that far away from us are.
That's fantastic. Is it still family owned?
It is. It's still family owned. They do have kind of unusual hours. They're not open on Mondays and Tuesdays, and most days they don't open until 5 o'clock. So you might want to call ahead if you're going to be heading down that way. It's quite a place. Look for the big red Coke sign on the front.
Lots of moss.
Lots of moss, lots of sort of quiet pools surrounded by palmettos. It's the sort of place that on the roads, this is, you know, maybe not the most appropriate subject when discussing food, but I'm always clued into the fact that I'm getting into true southern Louisiana when the roadkill on the side of the road turns from possums and raccoons to baby alligators. And it's definitely in that zone.
Well, it sounds delicious. Thank you for this really great swampy sort of a tip. Will you let us know what's going on again sometime soon?
I'm doing my best, Poppy.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter, Frank McMahon.
Hello, cats. I just got back, and I'm looking for that place they call a chicken shack. She's fine as wine, is really on the ball. No windows, no doors, it's just a hole in the wall.
After the next break, I'll introduce you to this week's culinary heritage hero, a farmer who nurtured our local farm-to-table movement. Stay tuned.
KRVS underwriting announcements reach listeners with your message of support and information about your business or event. To find out more about partnering with South Louisiana's Regional Public Radio Program Source, call us at 482-5787. 482-KRVS.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. And is this news?
I didn't always want to go to the senior center because I have arthritis, and my arthritis began to hurt. And I didn't want to go there and play bridge. It was much more fun to go shoplifting.
Bringing you all the parts of the world that don't fit into the daily news programs. Go out of your way for it. This American Life from Public Radio International.
7 p.m. Wednesdays on KRVS.
Oh, you don't need a stamp to enter the world of jazz. I'm DeJama Gagne, the host of Passport to Modern Jazz. Tuesdays at 10 p.m., I'm going to walk you through the gate and into the world of current jazz, back to New Orleans jazz earliest recordings, and won't leave out the Hammond B3.
Our music on the Thistle and Shamrock transcends boundaries, expands horizons, celebrates tradition, stimulates innovation. It's music to bring people together, so why don't you join us?
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, here on KRVS.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's culinary heritage hero is a North Shore farmer who abandoned life in the city in 1985, returning to the farm his family had worked since 1905. He worked the land the way his grandfather had, using the same horse-drawn plow. But with an eye to the future, our hero braved the way back to New Orleans in 1995 as one of the first vendors at the Crescent City Farmers Market. From the market's earliest days, the city chefs found a sympathetic ear in our culinary heritage hero, who understood their longing for authentic flavor and responded by being the first to experiment with unusual heritage varieties not previously available here. Our hero has fostered the love of the land in his grandson, AJ, who you will find selling their beautiful produce alongside his glamorous grandmother, Gladys, when he's not working the family farm. Yes, this week's Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you by Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, is Jim Corr of Taylor's Happy Oaks Farms in Folsom. Congratulations, Jim. You never cease to be an inspiration to us all. I'm Poppy Tooker, and farmer Jim Corr really knows how to grow Louisiana Eats.
Harold McGee is every chef's best friend. His 1984 classic on food and cooking demystifies food chemistry in a clear, factual way while serving up a delicious dose of food history as well. Since 2006, Harold has been a regular contributor to the New York Times with his column, The Curious Cook. Harold, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy. It's great to be here.
Since you're here in Louisiana, could we start by talking about the roux? Now, chemically speaking, what is the difference between a dark Louisiana roux and a classical French one?
Well, the dark one has basically been cooked more. And that does three different things. One is it changes the color. So instead of being kind of cream-colored, it's, whatever shade you want to make it, from light brown to chocolate brown to almost black. It also changes the flavor, because what's happening during that browning process is that sugars are reacting with proteins and generating lots and lots of aromatic molecules. And so the further you carry that cooking, the more aromatic the roux gets. On the other side is the fact that because you're generating all these delicious things from the starch materials, the starch is becoming a less effective thickener. So the darker you cook a roux, the more of it you need in order to get a particular consistency in the soup or the sauce.
Traditionally, people down here slow cook a roux. But I have found in my cooking that if I preheat the oil and add the flour and cook it pretty quickly, it saves a little time and it all comes out to the same milk chocolate brown color. Do you think there is a difference between a slow-cooked roux and a fast one chemically?
I'm sure there are chemical differences because reactions depend largely on time and temperature. And if you cook for a longer time at a lower temperature, you tend to get one set of reaction products. If you cook at a high temperature for a short period of time, you get a different set. But there's overlap. And my feeling is that probably if you do it both ways, and to you they taste basically the same and behave basically the same, then whatever differences there are inconsequential.
I know that salt and acid correct each other. How does that work?
It's a matter of balance. So we have just a handful of basic taste sensations: sweetness, sourness, bitterness, saltiness, and umami, which is the savory flavor of meats and fish and things like that. And it turns out that for a dish to taste at its best, all those elements have to be there in some sort of balance. And so if you have a preponderance of one or the other of any of them, adding the others will tend to bring that flavor down and raise the other ones up and then give you this kind of balanced foundation for whatever the aromas are. So that's what's going on, is that a little acid in a salty dish or a little salt in an acidic dish help even out that foundation.
Do you believe that salt is the most important flavoring ingredient?
It would have to be right up there. I mean, I'd hate to lose any of them, but if you lost salt, then you'd be losing not just saltiness, but a general effect that salt has on many aromas as well. It turns out that for a variety of reasons, if you add a pinch of salt to even a sweet dish, that can end up amplifying the aromas in that dish and just make it seem more flavorful. And other taste components don't do that in the same way. So that's an especially valuable property that salt has.
So the way that it amplifies the aromas, is that amplified in the mouth, or is it actually something that you could detect with your olfactory nerves?
It's something that's happening both chemically and in our brains, which is where perception happens. So it turns out that when you add salt to any dish with aroma molecules in it, it turns out that salt makes that dish less chemically hospitable to aroma, which means that the food will release the aroma more easily, which means that there's more of it for us to smell, more of it for us to enjoy. So that's one thing, is the flavor release. And then it also turns out that our brains tend to pay more attention to certain aromas when there are other things going on the taste buds. So if you just smell something, that's one experience the brain is having. But if you smell that same thing at the same time that you're tasting something, then what your brain says, I mean, this is my guess, is you're not just smelling something, you're actually eating something that has nutritional value, and therefore I'm going to have you pay more attention to that flavor. But it does turn out, just objectively speaking, if you give people a flavor with salt and without salt, when it comes with salt, the perception of the aroma, not the saltiness, but the aroma, goes higher.
Do you have a particular favorite kind of salt?
Well, not really. Not something about which there's a lot of, I would say, marketing these days. Salt is salt. Salt is sodium chloride. And the effects that I've been talking about are produced by sodium chloride. So the purest, most industrial version of salt is going to be just as good a job at that as the most expensive fleur de sel from France.
Thank you so much for talking with us on Louisiana Eats.
Oh, my pleasure, Poppy, anytime.
Food scientist and curious cook, Harold McGee. Kala, belle kala toucho, madame, belle kala toucho. This street call was commonplace in 19th century New Orleans. On special holidays, like All Saints Day, the kala vendors could be found at the cemetery gates, eager to sell their hot rice cakes to the families who came to whitewash and decorate the above-ground tombs of New Orleans' cities of the dead. Because kala were always a street vending tradition, not sold from a stand like beignets at the French market, when the street vendors disappeared in the middle of the 20th century, the kala almost became extinct. I've been on a mission to save the kala since becoming aware of their plight back in the 1980s. They're so easy to make and delicious. I hope you'll join in my effort as we have to eat 'em to save 'em. To make the basic sweet kala, take 2 cups of cold leftover rice. Add 6 tablespoons of flour, 2 teaspoons of baking powder, 3 tablespoons of sugar, and mix the dry ingredients together. Sprinkle on 1/2 teaspoon of vanilla and stir in 2 eggs to form a tight batter. Drop the kala by the tablespoonful into 365-degree oil. They'll brown on one side and then turn themselves over to brown on the other. Drain on paper towel, sprinkle powdered sugar on top, and serve while they're still hot. In my campaign to save the kala, I developed a way to serve them savory style too. Just leave out the sugar and the vanilla, add any savory ingredients like chopped up shrimp, crab or crawfish, or even tasso or andouille sausage. Use hot sauce in place of the vanilla and serve with a dipping sauce like remoulade. For a copy of this recipe, visit our website, wwno.org. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's.
Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakima Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.
If you miss donating your vehicle at the end of 2013, now's a great time to begin planning for your 2014 taxes. The KRVS Vehicle Donation Program is busy taking cars, trucks, and boats that our listeners no longer need. We've made it simple. Just call 877-KRVS-887 or donate online at krvs.org and we'll do the rest. From scheduling the pickup to sending you information for your taxes, we do it all. Just call 877-KRVS-887 today or go online at krvs.org.
Hi, this is Bill Bowens from The Dirty Rice Show, inviting you to join either Mr. Lee Kleinpeter or myself every Saturday night from 8:30 p.m. until 10 p.m. for Dirty Rice right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, public radio for Acadiana.
No better way to spend your Sunday night than relaxing and moving to 2 hours of some of the finest reggae sounds ever recorded right here on Jam On. Cecil here with some hard slapping grooves from the classic Studio One era up to today's finest reggae sounds. Jam On, Sundays 9 to 11 p.m.